Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
The Dalai Lama is one of the most recognisable figures in the world, but the future of this position is uncertain. The 14th and current Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, is 88 years old. He lives in India, having been exiled from his homeland of Tibet in 1959 following an uprising against China, which annexed Tibet in the early 50s. And since then, the issue of who will succeed him in this role has become a pressing question for Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism more broadly. There are fears the traditional process of selection may not be respected by Chinese authorities, who assert that important reincarnations must get approval from the government. John Powers is an honorary professor of Asian Studies and Buddhism at Deakin University in Melbourne. I spoke to him earlier in the week.
Well, the term Dalai Lama literally means ocean lama. Dalai is from a Mongolian word dala, meaning ocean, and it uses a genitive Tibetan particle to connect it with the Tibetan word lama or teacher. The idea is that he is an ocean of wisdom. Dalai Lama was a term conferred on him by a Mongol chieftain, and this is the one that he's best known by internationally, but it's not the one that the Tibetans generally use in referring to him. The current one, Tenzin Gyatso, is the 14th in the lineage, and he's one of hundreds, actually probably thousands, of reincarnate lamas. He is regarded by Tibetans as the most prominent of them, but this is not because he has any political position, which he doesn't, or any political power or anything like that. It's really in recognition of his predecessors, and also of the present one too, and of their accomplishments as religious and formerly political leaders.
Would I be right in saying that the Dalai Lama is essentially the head of Tibetan Buddhism? There are many branches of Buddhism, correct? But the Dalai Lama has a special relationship with Tibet?
Yes. Well, the Dalai Lamas are associated with Tibet. And prior to the Chinese invasion and takeover of Tibet in the 1950s, the Dalai Lamas were the rulers of Tibet, the political heads of Tibet from the mid-17th century. And so, but the present Dalai Lama, on his own volition, gave up any political role or any leadership role. And so whatever position he has is really a result of how Tibetans view him. The Dalai Lama, though, is not the head of Tibetan Buddhism or of Buddhism in general. He doesn't have any sort of position like the Pope or something like that. He has only the authority that people vest in him as a result of their estimation of him. The Dalai Lama is recognized as an important figure by all Tibetan Buddhists and is recognized as an important person by all the four lineages, orders of Tibetan Buddhism, but he doesn't have any special leadership role. He's not sort of a pope or anything like that.
You've spoken a couple of times about reincarnation. The Dalai Lama is thought to be reincarnated from lifetime to lifetime.
Yes, well, according to Buddhism, we all are. So in the Buddhist worldview, we all live in what's called samsara or cyclic existence. So we're born, we live, we commit actions, karma, and then we die. And then our next rebirth is conditioned by the karmas that we're creating in the next lifetime. So most of us are just caught up blindly in the cycle. We commit actions without understanding the consequences, without understanding the way the system works. And so we're sort of thrown powerlessly from one lifetime to the next. But some people are figure out the way things work, often as a result of being taught by others. And then they engage in meditative practice that helps them to see through the illusions of cyclic existence. And when you get to a high enough point, you're able to see the way the whole thing operates. And so these people who are on the path to this awakening are called bodhisattvas, or Buddhas in training. And at the end of this process, you become a Buddha, which literally means awakened. So a Buddha is someone who's woken up from the sleep of ignorance that most people are living in. According to Tibetan Buddhism, the Dalai Lama is a physical manifestation of Avalokiteshvara, or Tenrezig in Tibetan, who is the bodhisattva who embodies compassion.
The current Dalai Lama, the 14th Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso, is, it's probably fair to say, extremely recognizable to many people around the world. I'm sure that many of our listeners will be able to picture Tenzin Gyatso in their mind's eye. And that makes sense, I suppose. He has been the Dalai Lama for a very long time, and it's fair to say he has overseen some extraordinarily turbulent times for Buddhism and Tibet more broadly, would you say?
Well, absolutely. No Dalai Lama prior to him has gone through the sorts of upheavals and changes that he has. When he was born into a theocratic state, and the Dalai Lamas, and he was the current manifestation, were the heads of the Tibetan government. And then when the Chinese invaded, he had to flee. He fled initially to India, where he still has his headquarters. And then several hundred thousand Tibetans joined him in exile, and he set up an exile government, which is still functioning today. And he has really been the main figure in negotiating these changes of going from being the head of a Buddhist state in Tibet to living in exile, to being the person that the Tibetans mainly look to as the embodiment of their culture and their traditions, and of trying to keep these alive. And the most important ones for Tibetans have to do with Buddhism, and particularly with the monastic aspects of Buddhism.
You've referenced, John, a couple of times what you describe as the Chinese invasion of Tibet. Can you just explain a bit about that and the political and historical background to it, I suppose?
China traditionally had, Chinese imperial theory situated China as the Middle Kingdom or the Central Kingdom. And the idea was that China sat at the center of the world and was the center of civilization in the world. And the Son of Heaven, the Chinese emperor, claimed dominion over the entire earth, whether or not any Chinese had ever even visited it. And so that included, of course, all of the neighboring areas, including Tibet. And so from a very early period, China tried to establish at least a nominal control over Tibet. They weren't able to actually follow through on this until the 18th century, when for a brief period they were able to move in and take over the government. But as the Qing dynasty, the last imperial dynasty of China, weakened, Chinese control over Tibet and other peripheral areas also diminished. So although China continued to claim sovereignty over Tibet, the Tibetans exercised all of the signs of an independent state. They had their own government. They didn't ask China if they could pass laws. They didn't alter any laws because China told them to change them. They had their own postal service, their own military, which was completely independent of China. They had a legal system that was entirely derived from indigenous precedents. They issued passports. They had their own language, their own religion. And so although China made claims of sovereignty, they were bogus, and they continued to be bogus until the Chinese army invaded in 1950 and defeated the Tibetan army and took over the government. It has to do with imperialism. That's where the tensions are. That is, China is a totalitarian state that claims sovereignty over its neighboring states, and the official ideology of the Communist Party is that any area that has ever been under the control of China never has the possibility of returning to a sovereign status.
When we look at the Dalai Lama, both the 14th Dalai Lama and the role of the Dalai Lama now in 2024, Tenzin Gyatso is getting on now. I think he's 88 years old. And the issue of his successor is a big question for the future of Buddhism. But there are massive political undercurrents to this, pertaining to the relationship between China and Tibet and the role of the Dalai Lama. Can you explain a bit about those tensions that are at play there?
The background is that in the past, ever since the beginning of this creation of the institution of the Dalai Lamas, the reincarnations have been determined by people within the Gelugpa order. And so when a Dalai Lama dies, there are various sorts of signs that are looked to, like prognostications and things like that. Search parties are sent out. There are various sorts of divinatory examinations that are done. Children that are born around the right time are identified, particularly for being, promising or particularly bright or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so they're tested, and the testing is actually very rigorous, and it would take quite a while to go into how the tests would go. But basically, it's hard to imagine, for me at least, that anybody can pass these tests, because the idea is that because Tibetans believe that only the consciousness of the previous Dalai Lama is going to be able to pass all these tests in a new body now, they want to make sure that they get the right one. And so the integrity of that process is extremely important for Tibetans. And that's the thing that the Chinese actually don't understand. From the Chinese point of view, Dalai Lama is a term like postmaster, basically. Mm-hmm. It's something that a government has the authority to confer on whomever it wants. And so, but of course, from the Tibetan point of view, it's very important that the person who's designated as the 15th Dalai Lama passes all the tests indicating that he or possibly she is the reincarnated consciousness of the 14th Dalai Lama, Tenzin Gyatso. And so from the Chinese point of view, they can simply designate anybody they want. And they did this with the second most prominent reincarnate Lama in the Gelugpa Order of the Panchen Lama in 1995. The Tibetans went through the standard procedures of choosing a Panchen Lama. And when the Dalai Lama announced publicly who he had chosen as the designated reincarnation of the Panchen Lama, the Chinese government arrested him and his family. They still remain in detention today. He's one of the longest-serving political prisoners in the world. And they declared that the Dalai Lama's designation was illegal and invalid. That was their term. And they chose their own Panchen Lama, puppet Panchen Lama, who they installed, and they've made it very clear that they intend to use their puppet Panchen Lama to choose a puppet Dalai Lama. The problem with this, of course, is that the Tibetans are going to go ahead and choose a Dalai Lama of their own choosing. And the heads of the Gelugpa Order and probably other orders will be involved in this. And the Dalai Lama himself, following tradition, has indicated that he will that he has already chosen to not reincarnate in Chinese-controlled Tibet. But it's certainly going to be the case that the Tibetans will choose a successor to the Dalai Lama, and the Chinese will choose their own successor to the Dalai Lama. And so you'll have two, one supported by the Communist Party, and one supported by Tibetan exiles.
If the role doesn't have any codified political or religious power, why doesn't China just allow the process to go ahead?
That's a really good question. For them, it's part of a process of control. That is, it's not enough for the Communist Party to simply militarily take over Tibet. They also want to win the hearts and minds of the Tibetans, and they believe that by controlling Tibetan Buddhism, they can do that. And a lot of their propaganda in Tibet is about asserting government control over religious affairs and the thinking of religious people. And they invest an enormous amount of resources in this propaganda. It's been very unsuccessful so far. Tibetans that I've talked to, both inside and outside of Tibet, really dismiss the government's claims. But that doesn't stop them from trying, because this is a totalitarian regime that's not content with simply holding the territory. It also wants to control the minds of the people.
There was quite a bit of international, or maybe Western is a better word, concern about Tibet. In the 1990s, I remember celebrities sort of talking about this wider issue. Martin Scorsese made that film Kundun, which I imagine would have helped. But since then, it seems as though, I don't know whether you agree with this actually, but it kind of looks like the steam has run out a little bit, and maybe other causes have captured people's imaginations or hearts a bit more. Is there ongoing international pressure in this space, to the best of your knowledge?
Well, that's the problem. You're really right. And the Tibetans themselves are well aware of that. I was invited to a forum about 6 years ago now, called the 550 Forum, which was held in Dharamsala, which is the headquarters of the Tibetan exile government. Mm. And the main purpose of the forum was to discuss why the Tibet issue has fallen off the radar of people around the world, and why Tibet support groups are dwindling in numbers. And part of the reason, of course, is that China's hold is so thorough. And another problem is that journalists are not allowed in. Actually, really nobody is being allowed into Tibet now. And so you don't really get news of what's happening there, except, you know, sort of vague rumors of oppression and so forth. But in terms of firsthand accounts and people being able to actually go and look and see what's happening, it's getting more and more difficult all the time for foreigners to even go there and to see what's happening. And another problem is that there are a lot of other causes out there that are sort of calling for people's attention too. And I think personally, one of the biggest problems was that the Dalai Lama himself, he's a conciliatory sort of guy. His main proposal for the future of Tibet is what he called the middle way approach, which was an approach in which Tibetans would agree that China controls Tibet, that Tibet is a part of China. And in return, China would grant autonomy to the Tibetans, and so the Tibetans would be in charge of their own affairs, and there would be respect for human rights and less oppression and so forth. And China refused to consider any sort of modifications to its approach. And so the problem was that when the cause was Tibetan independence, people had something they could latch on to as a goal. And so as a result, people haven't really had a sense of what would it mean to even be supporting the Tibet cause, because the Tibetan exile government, including the Dalai Lama, have not really been very clear on what that means, aside from asking China to be a bit nicer.
In the round, how consequential is this situation for the future of Tibet, and indeed Tibetan Buddhism more broadly?
Well, it's probably pretty consequential, and it comes down to the inherent problems of the system of rule by reincarnate lama. That system was not designed for running a government, and it's a very bad way to run a government. So when it was originally formulated, it was a way of ensuring succession within a monastic situation. And so you had large monasteries with lots of property and lots of resources. And the other part of that was that they had religious teachings, lore that had to be passed on from generation to generation. And that required a large number, well, particularly with the largest monasteries, it required a large number of people with overlapping tenures, who could be trained in the systems, who could learn the rituals, the philosophies, and so forth, they teach them to others and so forth, and who could also pass on the resources of the institution without sexual intercourse. So these were celibate monks. And so how do you pass on the resource of a monastery from one generation to the next? And it was actually a brilliant system in that context. But with the fifth Dalai Lama, when he became the ruler of Tibet, as he was coming to the end of his life, his regent started, and he himself came to realize that they had a problem. That is, that when he died, there was going to be a huge gap in the Tibetan leadership, and it was going to last until the Dalai Lama attained maturity and would be able to be invested. The Tibetans tried to figure out ways of making the system work, but a system that was created for monastic succession left big gaps in leadership and a power vacuum between the death of one Dalai Lama and the investiture of the next one.
Well, that's an interesting component to it, isn't it? Is how the role has changed, and perhaps not necessarily with the will of the people who created and oversee the role. You know, a lot of people now would see the role of the Dalai Lama as sort of like a global ambassador for peace and spirituality, and, you know, humans getting along together and sort of, you know, living life in the right sort of way, when in fact its roots are in an entirely different place, a system of passing down power and governance, and that role has undoubtedly morphed significantly over the years and the decades, but it is still rooted in those traditions.
That's a good observation, and the present Dalai Lama realizes this. He has been working to reform the institution and to update it for the modern era pretty much through his whole life, and he has suggested various sorts of things, including making the position of Dalai Lama an elected position. He's been really working to implement democracy and to train Tibetans to think Tibetans in exile to think democratically. Obviously, it's not a possibility in Chinese occupied Tibet, but the Tibetans themselves are very much against that, because that would basically be the same sort of thing as what the Chinese government wants to do. That is to treat the title of Dalai Lama as a a title that can be conferred by people in authority. Whereas the reason why the Dalai Lama is important to Tibetans is because of the history and the associations of the present Dalai Lama and the previous Dalai Lamas, and the sense that this person is the physical reincarnation, the physical manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara. So simply naming some random person or even some widely respected person as Dalai Lama is not going to do the same work as the Dalai Lama institution has. And so despite his efforts, the Tibetans have really resisted this. And this shows, you know, that although Tibetans respect him and revere him and so forth, he often complains that they don't really pay much attention to what he'd like them to do.
It's a fascinating area, and it will be one certainly to watch over the coming years. John Powers, thank you so much for joining me and explaining that today. Really enjoyed it.
A pleasure. Good to talk to you.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.